I've been a bit wondering which of the two main research on China presenting you, and because the second one was more related to what we were talking about, but I think this is more, in a sense, it's more complex, richer, and that deserves a bit more of attention. So, moving across space, try to understand how heritage is managed in China. That is the research we were doing, we have been doing for 3 years. Now this is in Italian, I found, so maybe. I'm trying to, I will pass very quickly the first point of what I mean by management. You should have already understood in this couple of days. If not, there's no way to make me understood. But I will talk about some of the methodological issue of this difficult research in China and some of the preliminary findings. And I'll show you very soon a beautiful movie that we made on one of the case studies, and then I'll show you some other preliminary findings. So, basically, let me pass very quickly. I'm interested in management, and history. It's a micro focus. I'm not that much concerned with policies, but with practices. And I'm talking about general management more than site management or museum management. It's management as such. And I'm looking at cultural heritage organization as professional entities, professional organization, trying to understand how they work as organizations, and particularly the issue of economic sustainability, feasibility. As we mentioned, this is a very controversial area all over the world. It's related to the transformation of public sector. It's impossible to understand how heritage is managed in China if you don't understand what happened in public sector in the last 30 years after Deng Xiaoping. If I'm going to study in Syria, it would be very difficult for me to understand what's the context and the general administrative context. I'm trying to do the same research in Turkey. And the real problem is not understanding archaeological sites or museums, which is a problem, but it's really the trajectory of change in administration. But really this terrible need of international comparison. I need to understand internationally, comparatively internationally, what's happening in this field. So this was a 3 years field research. I was spending 1 month and a half a year for 3 years of those, you know, days for 7 o'clock in the morning till midnight for 7 days a week, and that is almost half a year full time. And of course, doing this kind of international research, you cannot ask me to know all languages. So I don't know Chinese. I can't read Chinese. I can't understand any single word of Chinese. 4 words I was able to learn in 7 years. I'm not very good in languages. So most of my time was really, and most of the effort was really building up an international team, a senior Italian team to deal with. And that was one of the most difficult things. I mean, particularly when you have to talk to accountants, trying to understand how it works accounting in Chinese museums, and you're talking in accounting with different language, and their translator is an archaeologist. They do not understand of both of us. So it was really funny. It's something very difficult. It's a really field research. Trying to understand, in the shoes of professionals, trying to understand a kind of ethnographic kind of research, basically. We were not working with academics, partly because of, for personal connections, we were working with inside public administration in China. I had connection with someone at Beijing, a couple of people at Beijing, at the state administration, they had friends, you know, that's like Italy, that's Guangxi, that the family is everything in China, as in Italy, the connections are everyone, everything. So we were able to get access to data, and for this kind of research is really crucial. You have to find people that are willing to share data with you and understanding with you, otherwise it's not the kind of research that you can do. But we were not working with academics. It's like if we were doing research on Italian archaeologists, working with the people in Pompeii rather than the people in Rome or in university in Naples. So, and it's sort of action research. It was in a sense a bit of research in the beginning. In the end, they were using us as a sort of expert or consultant and so on. So we are very far from the kind of positivistic, detached kind of research. We want to be involved. We want to get our hand dirty and share things, experience, and so on. That's a nice tradition of research and management. And there's one thing that the value of this research is that very, very unusual bias. We, you know, double checking the information that you get from people in China is impossible if you don't read Chinese. So in a sense, we were totally hostages of Chinese officers. So basically, it's a journey inside public sector in China, spending a relatively consistent period of time inside public sector, and writing about that with access of data that is impossible to have normally. We are, hopefully we are at the last revision with China Quarterly, which is one of the best journal, and the editor herself said, well, you have such a unusual, huge, unique set of data. I mean, we were able to publish financial accounting data of the museums we were working at. Even Chinese scholars are unable to get access normally. As far as you don't publish in Chinese, we were allowed to do anything. Okay. And the book itself, there are two parts. One is a sort of general trends in China, and we were asking these officers to write chapters on archaeologists, write on museology, on curatorial disciplines in China, and so on. And of course, in the beginning we have the only academic we had in the beginning then disappeared. And I remember it was an archaeologist, and when we were left alone, we were trying in this meeting to understand each other, what we were looking for, what we were asking them to do, and it was very explicitly pointing out, Professor Zhang, you want to expect me to tell you what I think. I write you what I can. You know, China is a difficult country, and archaeology is one of the tools for this kind of very aggressive kind of nationalism and identity building, you know, China. The Chinese civilization, which is a stupid way of, according to some, to Robert Bagley, which is one of the Princeton biggest archaeologists on Shang Dynasty, they say, come on, the question is the civilization in China, not Chinese civilization, as was something distinct, different from anyone else. So, of course, this is the bias we have. So, in a sense, you can quote from the first word to the last word, and that's the value of our book, the bias, the view from inside. And this is China, more or less. Here we have the Henan province, has been, Luoyang in particular, the municipality, a huge prefecture, has been a capital for 13 dynasties. So this is the most important, historical part of China. Beijing is a relatively new area. So the focus, we are trying to understand changes And we have this beautiful word, which is their archaeological chain. So it's just, you know, from discovery, research, conservation, presentation to museum, it's a sort of chain of activities. And the notion of change is usually is used in industrial organizations to try to see the relationship between different parts. So we wanted to see, to study the evolution of archaeological chain in the last decades and what kind of managerial challenges this pose. I'm not saying challenges to managers, but challenges in managing ways. And one of the most important challenges is the shift, the relative shift in importance between on-purpose or salvage excavation, rescue excavation. Basically, they build so much. They construct street houses, cities, railways, and they find enormous amount of archaeological remains. Sometimes they destroy everything, sometimes they preserve, sometimes they do in the good and the bad. But it's because of the booming economy in the last 30 years. I mean, that is really one of the most fascinating developing country, I would say, in the history of human being, not right now. I mean, defining such an economic revolution in 30 years' time, it's one of the most fascinating area of the research. When I started doing this, this kind of research was really fascinating. So what I'm trying to do is, what happens in China? It is the kind of issue that we found in Machu Picchu, in Pompeii, in the kind of conflict in British Museum, the kind of discourse that we were talking about, the issue of effectiveness, efficiency, different conflict between different levels of administrations. Is there something similar happening in China? Issue of coordination between macro and micro issues, where you get money, where you spend money, and so on. Budget, business plan, sustainability issue. So let's try to see what is there in China. And we were, as a good management scholar, we are working on case studies. As a good management scholar, I'm doing some advertising of my other book on managerial rhetoric. And based on this, we were trying to prepare a sort of similar structure for case studies. Never mentioned the word mission. We were trying to focus on the element of interest of individual case that we were selecting. We were trying to study their history and identity. Most of the time when you use the word mission and you have something serious to say, please talk about identity. I think that's a very crucial point. It's not the, you know, the objective willingness of an organization, is the identity that people find in this history, in this evolution. Then we were addressing issues of effectiveness, both in terms of curatorial effectiveness, using the framework that I was suggesting or showing you yesterday, and all the back office from a curatorial conservation point of view, research historian point of view, and when needed, when possible, for visitors. We were also studying organizations that were not open to visitors. We were studying archaeological teams, so there's no visitors, of course. And it's funny because, I mean, if you specialize on this strange field as site management, museum management, you never look at archaeologists in managerial terms. So we were looking at how archaeologists work. And what is really, really, really unique in our work from the very beginning, I was saying very explicitly, maybe even too much, but they really accept it. We are not writing any single word of celebration. You know, if you read about China, you are the biggest, the oldest, they use always this overtone of celebration, which is really disturbing. I'm not interested in that. I'm not willing to spend a second on that. I'm using my critical view. You know, what I like, you know, in management studies, when you have this, even sometimes we sell it too simplistically, the SWOT analysis, strengths and weaknesses, threats and opportunities. Take it seriously in a completely different context and you understand how important it is. We are just looking at strength, but also we want to understand problem, weaknesses. We want to understand opportunities, but we want to understand what does not work. And it says, I really discover a hidden value in a SWOT analysis in China. It's a critical view that address issues, problems. So that could be very useful. And we were also addressing issues of efficiency, use of human resources. In all organizations, all case studies, all entities we went in, there is a responsible of the Communist Party. So it's a very strange organizational chart with a Communist Party representative, which is not very easy to understand. And we were talking about financial resources. We get access to financial resources. We were questioning, we spend enormous amounts of time in looking at public sector Chinese accounting. And I spent really, that was one of the most difficult things in my life. And then I found also a Chinese colleague that was in Lausanne for a sabbatical, and we started working together, and we were understanding completely different things. She was reading papers, I was just looking at practices. It's fascinating. But I think I get it, understand a lot. And we had this access to data. Most of the time, a lot of these sites were interested in developing projects, so we were also addressing the issue of what is going to happen, what the project, what about the projects. Then a short summary, and the more we were going on, the more we had to write some sort of recommendation, advices, and so on. So between scholars and consultants. So these are the some of the case studies. The first is the Cultural Relics Bureau in Luoyang, which is the entity which is managing, coordinating the whole staff, which is the local responsibility for heritage. Then we were looking at two archaeological teams and trying to see how excavation works, from an administrative point of view, what are cost and revenues, what are incentive mechanisms. These kind of things. I mean, I love this. I should write sooner or later a book on archaeoeconomics. I mean, I love this kind of, you know, no one really do serious work on the economics of archaeological work. It's so fascinating. Then we have a new museum, and I have the movie of that, the 15-minute movie on the new museum. That's a new discovery. They were building a parking lot and they found something, they stopped everything, and in 18 months they were opening a new museum, beautiful, and you will see it. And this is, in a sense, a happy ending story. So we are tired, it's Friday, you already listened to me talking too much, so I want to end up with a happy ending. So, the new museum. Then we were looking at Luoyang Museum, which is the most important, very badly managed, run by a lady, which is a painting, a Communist Party painter. I mean, it's a very important name on the nomenclatura, and it's an artist, but more than an artist, it's a really political, powerful lady. And then we were looking at another museum with very serious problem of conservation of tombs that were reproduced. And it's funny because when you see it, say, come on, it's the water inside, everything inside, it's a disaster. Then after a few months, you realize that everything basically is a replica. So who cares? So you can do the replica once again. So that's another happy ending. That's it's a temple, something in a temple, and it was developed, that was the place in front was full of illegal building. They were cleaned up, spending a lot of money for compensation, getting a loan from the bank, and the cost of the loan was charged to this entity that was close to bankruptcy. It's Hemingway, another site that was lost anywhere, and I'll show you some pictures. Longman Grottoes is the most important site. This is UNESCO site. It's one of the three most important grottoes in China. Beautiful. And also we look at one county administration just to see the problem of level between administrations. So we were doing 9 in-depth case studies and 3 years of research. So it's time for our movie. Let's hope it works and enjoy it. I mean, this is the movie. It's the quality is not particularly good. We got the video, the permission from them. It was 1 hour movie. Then we just cut it down and reconstruct a totally different audio. So that the we were using the video, but the text is largely our text.
With great cultural heritage, which today is going through an important economic transformation. Due to fast-paced development and construction, archaeological discoveries are becoming widespread, bringing about new problems in the management of this cultural heritage. Today, the city of Luoyang finds itself in the middle of an urbanization process. Located in central China, Luoyang has been the capital of 13 imperial dynasties over the past 2,000 years, including the dynasty of the Eastern Zhou. For the past 50 years, the administration of Luoyang has been seeking the best way to balance this powerful urban development with the significant archaeological discoveries. In 2002, the municipality of Luoyang decided to build a new square along the main street of the city. The project proposed several public spaces, a shopping center, and an underground parking garage. To create space for the new square, many different buildings in the area were demolished. However, not even a year later, the municipality abandoned the project. Thanks to a series of preliminary investigations, they discovered that the grounds contained important remains from the Eastern Zhou Dynasty. In fact, according to the Luoyang Law for Cultural Heritage Protection of 1985, after the demolition of old buildings and before beginning construction on new ones, archaeological detection activities are required. The Luoyang spade has been used since the beginning of the last century by the local population to steal from the ancient tombs. Today, the archaeologists also use this tool. The spade is inserted deep into the ground and brings up a sample from the earth from which we can observe the composition of the different layers. Through this process, we can completely analyze the situation of the area and collect important information for the archaeological digs. During the detection activities in the square, various relics were found. Thus, according to the law, a large-scale archaeological excavation was conducted. This led to the discovery of 400 tombs, 36 horse and horse and chariot pits, and more than 1,000 relics of the Eastern Zhou royal dynasty. The discovery is of extraordinary value, and the cemetery is unmatchable in its dense arrangement of the tombs and the highest rankings of the burials. Although some interpretive issues still seem to remain open, the finding is of great significance in studying the chariot structure and burial institution of the Eastern Zhou, as well as the layout of the royal mausoleum precinct and even the entire city of the then royal capital. It is particularly fascinating that they discovered chariots and horses, preserved in perfect condition. Historians are baffled as to how the horses came to be there. Some say the animals must have died in battle or in a landslide, while others believe they were buried as part of their owner's funeral service. Judging from the position of the horses, it seems that in any case, they died before the burial. Also, the structures of the chariots are rather interesting. All are square except for one, which is round and particularly striking. The discovery had an enormous impact at both the national and international levels. In December 2002, a well-known local newspaper printed the headline, "Discovery of the Imperial Tomb of Luyang, Theory Confirmed of the Emperor with Six Horses." Also in Hong Kong, the headlines read, "The surprising discovery of the Imperial Tomb of the Zhou Dynasty in Luang is comparable to the discovery of the Terracotta Warriors." The most noteworthy of the pits of the chariots and the horses discovered in the area of the square is the central pit number 5. The pit is 42 meters long and 7 meters wide, with a total of 26 chariots and 68 horses. The remains found in the grave consist of a great processional party. The chariots are organized into two rows, and each of these is drawn by 2 or 4 horses. Found close to 7 of the chariots were also the remains of dogs. The position of the dogs suggests that they were buried alive and killed during an attempt to escape from the tomb. The second chariot of the western row is the only to be pulled by 6 horses. This discovery confirms the theory that during the Zhou Dynasty, only the emperor had the right to use 6 horses for his chariot. It is thus very likely that the tomb and the pit found in the central square of Luyang were of the same emperor, and that the site is even older than that of the Qin Dynasty, which is most well known as the tomb of the Terracotta Warriors. In January 2003, experts from the State Administration for Cultural Heritage were summoned to appraise the value of the discovery. Following this appraisal in April 2003, a decision was made by the administration to definitively stop the initial plans of construction of the parking lot and build an on-site museum. The Museum of Horse and Chariot Pits of the Emperor of the Eastern Zhou Dynasty was established in the original site where the main pit number 5 was excavated. The construction of the museum started immediately in June 2003. In September of that year, the museum building was completed, finally opening its doors on October 1st, 2003. A shopping center and 2 temporary semi-underground buildings were also opened in the area of the square, where several other tombs and pits have been found after excavation. The museum displays the history of the Eastern Zhou Dynasty, with a particular focus on the royal family. The museum is a semi-underground construction covering an area of 2,000 square meters, of which 1,700 square meters are used for exhibits and public services, and 300 square meters are used for offices and back office spaces. The exhibition area is divided into 2 parts. The first hall displays 186 objects and finds from the Eastern Zhou Dynasty. These objects have been collected from diverse sites and museums and are of great historical and artistic value. The setup of the exhibit, which is simple and modern, enhances the beauty of the objects and is an effective introduction to the second hall. This second hall, with an area of around 800 square meters, displays the procession of horses and chariots from the pit number 5 in its complete grandeur and beauty. Large in scale and still intact, the pit is reputed to be a unique and major clue into China's history from the 21st century BC. Also, the state of preservation is relatively unusual. The pit was perfectly preserved, with the 6-horse skeleton still tied to the chariot they were pulling. The car had a copper axle, which has never been discovered before. Bronzeware and jade unearthed from the burial site are also in good shape, which is unique, as usually 90% of graves are empty upon discovery. Historical value, in this case, is coupled with an emotional site, that is, a site which creates an intensive emotional impact, even for the general visitor. Since its opening in October 2003, the museum has welcomed over 80,000 visitors per year. The new institution appears to be a modern museum. Good design, clear structure, modern setup and exhibit solutions, and a horse and chariot pit which is particularly impressive.
So, this is a very good example to describe in a short time the working of archaeology in China, and that was a happy ending, could be happier in a sense. I mean, there was a by law, they are assumed to provide a report on excavation, restoration, and research, and they didn't. So no one really knows what they did and what will happen with this very fragile kind of findings. I mean, in 20 years' time, what will be evaporated, perhaps. It's a very controversial and, but in a sense, it could be worse. I mean, it could be the total destruction. So. And here is the organizational chart. I think we should present also sooner or later the Chinese organizational chart. That could be a paper on its own. I mean, the way in which Chinese design organizational chart, I remember when the friend of mine was in Bologna, he was trying to explain to me the structure. I was using my software with the organizational chart. And then yes and no, yeah, but it's the same level, but it's not exactly the same level. There's a very soft aspect in organizational design in China that maybe no software is able to deal with. But there are very interesting elements here. First, there is the local government. This is the municipality. Because the area is particularly important, the Cultural Relics Bureau is directly reporting to the mayor. Normally, or the rest of China, the Cultural Relics Bureau is reporting to the cultural department. The fact that it's on the same level means status, prestige, and status and prestige is everything in Chinese bureaucracy. There is a administrative line to the local authority, and this is a dotted line, a sort of scientific, academic overview by the Cultural Relics Bureau at the province level and at the state level. This already explained most of the problem with China. I mean, China, and this is the first astonishing thing that you discover after a few days that you start reading about China, is the most decentralized country in the world. It's too much decentralized. 90% of expenditure in heritage takes place not at the ministry level, nor at the province level, but at the town level. Okay? So that means, you know, we have a ministry in Italy of 25,000 people. The ministry in Rome is all about 3,000 people. The ministry in Beijing is something as 600 people, with a total of 70,000 people working in China. So it's very decentralized. And this is part of the problem. Why? Because it is exact the other extreme of the Italian situation. We have the ministry and we have the local representative of the ministry, the superintendenti, and this is one of the good element in making professional control. What I mean, if there is some sort of building project, land speculation, you as a professional will say, come on, this is destroying this heritage, don't do it. And if the major himself is involved in interest in legal or illegal terms, with corruption or not corruption, they'll say, no, we do it because maybe not simply for corruption, but because this will construction will mean for him in terms of power, in terms of result to use in his career development, something important. And say, yes, we have to do it, but we are destroying this heritage. We have to do it. Please don't do it. We have to do it. And you have a family. You have a kid, not two, but one kid. And you say, okay, you have to give it up. I mean, you get the bread and butter by the mayor. And you can try to resist him or her, him, I would say, 90% of the time. But you have no power. This is why there is no resistance to destruction, systematic destruction, if not in very marginal situation, very lucky situation like this one. In Italy, it would be very different. If the mayor in Bologna, in Venice, in Milan, were interested in some sort of land speculation, even with bad intention with corruption, I mean, the superintendent reports to the ministry. So they could resist much more in terms, I don't care, I don't take my salary from you, I don't, it's not you I have to report to. So this is the very, you know, when they're talking about, Italy have been working very hard since the 90s in China, so they know a lot of Italians, and they refer to the Cultural Relics Bureau when they are talking with us, with the Italian name, Superintendenza, and I was telling them, no, there's nothing more different than the Superintendenza. This is the, and I, studying with Chinese and studying in China, I discover the positive elements of centralization of the Italian system. And these are 19 entities that are reporting to the Cultural Relics Bureau. Here you see there are question marks, and we published the book with a question mark. I mean, in 3 years' time, I've not been able to understand whether the Longmengrotto report to the Cultural Relics Bureau or not. I've not been able to. I have different evidence. We had a lot of conversation with the director, and he was unsure himself. And in the end, say yes, they report to myself, so they, okay. Then I discovered that all other offices send their financial statement to the Cultural Relics Bureau. Longmengrotto send directly the financial report to the local department of finance ministry. So they don't even send the financial statement to the Cultural Relics. So perhaps it's a very ambiguous kind of status. It seems to be a very structured organization. It's 19 entities because the importance of heritage in this area, normally you have two or three. Here you have 9 museums and other kind of. But in fact, this seems to be, for what I understood, is a much more formal, apparent kind of organization. The real capability of the director to be in control of what happens in the hierarchy is weak, in my understanding. And I will come back on this later. So, you see the first case, and trying to make some general consideration more than going in depth on each individual case studies. If we want to talk about the effectiveness of in this reality, there's something very strange related to the specific nature of cultural heritage in Luoyang will be different in Beijing, it will be different in Nanjing, it will be different in any other place. But because of the heritage, which is mainly archaeological remains, buried archaeological remains, mainly archaeological site and excavation of the since the Shang Dynasty to the Tang, so basically between 1400 BC till 900 AD, most of it, according to Chinese culture and Chinese tradition, is made of wood and earth, which means it's mostly going, it's gone or it's going. And when you made this excavation, they were very lucky to find this good conservation, comparatively speaking. Some of the time you have just small piece of earth, and that was the monument, it's an important monument of this on that dynasty. So in terms of managerial implication, there are three levels at least. One, in terms of the concept, the museum concept or the site concept, it's incredibly difficult to protect. Water destroyed, wind destroyed in a matter of years. And this is a very crucial point in the history of China and the history of the second dynasty, according to the textbook, the Shang Dynasty, which seems to be the first dynasty that have archaeological evidence, which is something that is a bit embarrassing from a political point of view, because they were investing a lot of resources to prove that the Chinese are older than the Egyptian, and in the end they discovered there are no empirical evidence that the Xia dynasty ever existed as such. So that's really embarrassing from that point of view. So they are crucial value for historians, for archaeologists, and could be very, very irrelevant for visitors. Look at this. This is the Capital Museum. This is a wall that is much younger than me and has been done a few years ago. And inside of it, there is the earth. And there is a window in which you can see the earth that sounds to us Westerners, perhaps, as a sort of fetishism. Who cares looking at the earth? You know, why you have to rebuild all this stuff? Or this is totally fake. There's nothing real here, and this is a reproduction of what is out inside, and it's not even maintained or kept or so on. And this as well, apart from these buses here, is totally fake, totally. So who cares? Would you pay, willingness to pay? Would you go there and spend 20 or 10 euros or even less to see this kind of, you know, totally built, not even rebuilt building. I think this is something that could be, it's a crime against humanity. I mean, this is how the site it is. This is an Anhui site. And when I saw this picture, I didn't even realize that is the same. That is what they were excavating. And this is how they packaged it. And this is the China Academy of Social Sciences, the Institute of Archaeology, that were doing that. That's a crime. I mean, it's irreversible. There's no, I mean, all the kind of professional values that you can. So, would you go there to see this kind of rubbish construction? It's not even reconstruction. Would you spend money to go there? And I think no one will go. So basically, you have this an enormous value. I mean, the pagoda, that was a remain of a pagoda. This earth remain of the pagoda is crucial for historians to understand some controversial turning point in the historiography, in the Chinese historiography, but no value at all for the visitors, which is something very strange. You never find in UNESCO criteria that site should be appealing, should be nice to see, otherwise no one will go there. And There's not something interesting from an organizational point of view. The system that the movie was describing is the, when you do excavation, you have to make some preliminary detection. If something is found, the archaeological team came and make excavation. What I'm not sure the movie was telling, it is the company, the one who was doing the work, that will pay for the excavation. So basically, this is the first time in my life that I found rich archaeologists. Archaeologists are the richest group in this organization. They get an enormous amount of money. And so, you know, you think, wow, we found this solution. You made developers paying for testing and excavation. You fund with developer money archaeological excavation, and it was my assistant. But that's a good solution. I don't see the problem. But come on, there's always a problem. When you find that today's solution is the tomorrow, the problem of tomorrow. So the problem of tomorrow is that there's such kind of incentive to dig and dig and do nothing but dig, because you get money for digging, not for doing research, not for writing reports, not for conservation. So basically these people are always making just digging, and there is a lack of exploitation of knowledge and information about these discoveries. There's no budgets or organizational rules that say every 100 years, every 100 yuan that you get, you have to spend it on research, on of maintaining or conservation. No, so they're just getting money for doing that. Also, there are no normal rules for allocating resources to conservation, to research. So the only thing, the only way to get money to do something else is to the logic of special project. You do new things. Here's something that is very fascinating from my point of view. There is this kind of what I call a real estate understanding of organizational change. If you want to do something different, you have to build physically something. They are so good in doing new things. They are so bad in maintaining things. You have a problem with the museum. You build another museum and never go back to restructuring the museum. So it's really fascinating. And of course, as if it happens in the British Museum, it happens in Pompeii, it happens everywhere, it happens in China as well. No emphasis on running cost. There is a project of the 5 years plan of developing 100 new archaeological parks, and I don't remember how many hundreds of new museums, where money are budget in terms of initial investment cost, and no one is taking care of running cost of these sites. Even from an organizational point of view, it's a very rich area. So there are many entities inside the Cultural Heritage Bureau, and outside there is also temples. There are other organizations that are not run by them. And here is the notion, an issue of institutional fragmentation, which is a very common issue in China. It's a very common issue in cultural heritage. It's a very common issue in China's cultural heritage. So you have duplication of resources. You have different teams, the archaeological teams. The division of labor between the two archaeological teams is one of the, I would say, the most stupid, if I'm allowed to say that. One is taking care of the east part of Luoyang, and the other is taking care of the west part of Luoyang. Is not by period, by dynasty, by technologies. It's simply by, you know, it's really a territory. It's a, that's mine, that's your. And they have two depots. They have two restorers, two set of restorers. They don't talk to each other. They don't share knowledge. But also in the area, there are four teams, four, Erlito, Yanxi, they are very important sites by the China Academy. There are four teams. We were not able to get in to see the depot, and the people in Luoyang cannot go there. And all the four different teams, with their depot, with their restoration, with their conservation, with their research, and so on. It's a, to really a duplication of resources, lacking the development of knowledge across the archaeological chain, and so on. There are very clear rules of destination of object. You can keep the object for 3 years, then you have to give to the local museum or to the national museum. That's the rules. China, what I like in China is it's like Italy. There are lots of rules, nobody really following the rules. So basically, if you want to see the best collection, you have to find some friend in the Institute of Archaeology. Even in Beijing, they have such a, they shouldn't have any object by law. They have one of the best museum because they keep the best object and it's really beautiful. And there's no incentive in this context for desk research. Now the question in terms of effectiveness, what about visitors? And visitors are very different figures. You have 900,000 visitors in Longmen Grotto, you have 80,000 visitors in this new museum, you have 20,000 somewhere else. And they don't seem to be any kind of capability of making things change. And I was talking with the director, and he was saying that museum is badly managed, both from the point of view of how they keep object in terms of view. He knew everything. I said, come on, why don't you make it change? You are the boss. He said, I can't do anything. I cannot fire them, I cannot take disciplinary actions, and so on and so forth. He knew everything. But I was really shocked by the situation of anarchy in a socialist country. I mean, anarchy and socialism have never been very good in dealing together. I mean, but this is a it's a funny situation. I mean, there's no power to intervene. I mean, it's really something that the management of human resources has nothing to do with what normally perceived as the management of human resources. It's political control, it's disciplinary control, as ruled by the Communist Party. But it's funny, it's fascinating. I never thought that something as such was possible. And also what is interesting in terms of, you know, there's an excess of competition in a sense between these entities. And when I was presenting this research in Carnegie Mellon, there was a colleague, she was in Longmen Grotto a couple of weeks before, and she was getting furious when she saw my movie. I said, come on, nobody told me that there is this new museum. It's already open 5-6 years ago, if not more, 2003. Nobody told her. I mean, there's no way of, you know, it's trying to manage visitors, trying to move visitors, trying to, nothing as such. And this is our numbers. These are even income. And you see, we were also trying to look at different performance indicators, the kind of game I was playing this morning with the archaeological site. I mean, there are, in terms of performing, in terms of paying visitor amongst all visitors, there are no, it seems to be no rules. I mean, the lady, the painters, it was just 21% of visitors pay in the museum. By the way, that was crazy, never happened to me. We were talking with this lady, she was painting, it was not caring that much what we were saying, she was painting, and we were maybe a bit nervous about asking visitors' numbers. And she called a lady, and the lady came with the receipt of the ticket and start counting the ticket. Come on, come on. And, you know, and you have, in other places, completely different. So there are, I hate the word best practice, but I mean, good practice are not able to move across this museum. The director himself knew perfectly, but he's unable to do something. Look at terms of income per visitors. The difference, I mean, that's 2.2, no, it is 22 perhaps, 22 yuan, this is 92. This is the Austrian chariot, it's so, I mean, it's completely different. or the relationship between visitor and permanent employees. You know, that's another very interesting thing. When you manage, when you run a new entity, there's not a kind of planning. How much do you need in terms of people, because this is the kind of job that you're doing. There's not any evaluation of the needs for human resources. You get numbers according to the level of the organization that you are. It's a question of prestige, it's a question of hierarchies of different organizations. So, in terms of visitors, in terms of, let me see if I'm able to look at the comparison between the Luoyang Museum with 30,000 visitors and the Horse and Chariot had 80,000 visitors, and they had, what is the permanent, 13 employees against 50. There's no relationship between what you do and the number of people that you have, because they were able to charge to the visitors, they were able to raise some additional staff on contract, a kind of non-permanent position. That's another paper that needed to be written sooner or later, than later, in terms of new post, new jobs, unsure, unregulated jobs all over the world, in Machu Picchu, as well as in China, and as well as in Italy. So it's interesting to see there is no way to managing visitors. It's something that is totally out the. So this is more or less what we are already talking about. And also you have, of course, this kind of intrusion of politics. You have the total lack of any human resource management notion. You know, people, there are a lot of debate in China about the lack of talent. My point is, it's not a question of talents, it's the lack of criteria of selecting, hiring, moving, career, rewarding people across the salary, across their career. You know, this is something that you can find papers that are talking about that. I was just finding a paper a couple of days ago, and it was very clearly pointing out the issue of the need to develop policy of human resource management. It is impossible to find paper simply describing what is happening. So there's nothing more different from human resource management than what is the social political practices in this area. These are numbers, just to see that we have numbers. Well, let me show you, this is financial statement of a museum. Every single entity has its own financial statement. 1 million entities have this financial statement. This is assets, this is assets, liabilities, this is the net, and this is income, and this is expenditure. Very strange, very complicated. But now I know everything about it. It seems to be financial statement, balance sheet, and income statement. Actually, it's a very complicated issue. It's too late, and it's too Friday afternoon to go into detail. But what is really fascinating is, let me just try to describe. I was doing this research on the field, and I was trying to understand in the field without having an accountant being able to talk with me in English or in Italian, but I was looking at things and I was understanding that it was so difficult to get what I normally wanted, which is an income statement and financial statement. And I understood it as an animal, as an accountant animal. I was just, you know, talking by hand and with people. And when I met this friend of mine, she was reading the papers, and she was reading documents, she was reading laws and regulations, and she came out, now there must be this and this and this, and no, there is not such a thing. So basically, understanding by practice and understanding by papers, we came out with some of, you know, interpretation that was totally unable to to touch. And in a sense, when you read carefully, and you at the first sight you read, I read the translation she was writing, that there must be an income statement, an income and expenditure statement, and we read it carefully. It's not really saying that. There must be income and expenditure. There's not written that there's any place where you can match income and expenditure. That the notion of surplus, saving, profit, whatever it is not there. And in a sense, it's fascinating, this kind of misunderstanding. And this is one of the papers we're writing. It's a bloody accounting history paper on the kind of misunderstanding between what was asked by the World Bank during the 80s and 90s, what they pretend or to understand or really understanding, but seen from that point of view, not really getting what they were asking. So in a sense, you know, this kind of game by people that pretend to understand, each has his own agenda that works. It's an ambiguous language that satisfies both sides. So the World Bank thinks that they're introducing accounting system like we do in the West to modern form of management. They can still go on with their logic without transforming too much. And that is fascinating. But once again, it's the whole rhetoric of managing, I mean, it's something that is totally irrelevant. I mean, you have you have the appearance, the surface of management. You have this kind of different museums, and naive, you think they are in charge of, they are responsible for. So I was spending a lot of time talking with individual director and accountants. They don't have any power at all. The director was asking me from the very beginning, I really don't know why you're wasting your time talking with them. You should talk with me. So come on, let me understand. I have my own way to understand. Then in the end, I will talk with you. So, but this is something very accounting can give you the information you want. They give you numbers, and I say, come on, but there is no the bookshop here. And the bookshop normally is related to the family, to the private firm, or some of the Communist Party people, or the director family, and so on. So yes, no, there's no. But if you want, I can put you. And so what you get is what you ask for, in a sense. So it's not really black economy, though we found something that was really clear, close to corruption, to mistakes of corruption. But there's not an issue that an entity should report as such. There is not an accountability issue, which, to be honest, I'm not so surprised after being in Pompeii, which was not that different. And a lot of other things that you would find is so different. So basically, what is really satisfying, then I'm stopping for the last conversation and discussion, it's really how you have this seemingly convergence both of professional practice and administrative practice. To what extent professional practice are converging is an open issue. When you discover that, you know, in any places everything is fake, that's an interesting point, and I guess there's a very different tradition in that. And I guess they're good, they're right in making replica and making fake sites because they have millions of visitors. So it's good, perhaps it's something that is out of our culture, but there is a tradition and there is some rationale, especially with this kind of million tourism ready to boom. On administrative issues, really, there's nothing far than Chinese management system to what we normally think in terms of, you know, this kind of responsibility, accountability. Decisions are made on other level with other logics. I mean, there is a real important, crucial political cycle. If you are the mayor of Luoyang, you have 5 years to play the game. And if you win, you get promoted to the next step. And whether it's a plan, it's not a plan, who cares about running cost? I mean, if that happens in London, can you imagine how that happens in Luoyang? So there is this ritualism of this pretty detailed accounting system that no one really cares. And the director was saying, I mean, I was really questioning, and I'm really stopping, because I wanted to understand, and I found something that was really no sense, and I found several mistakes, and said, this does not fit with that. And accountants, the nine accountants was really scared by me, come on. And the director told me, look, you know what? You are the first person that is looking at this data. No one really asked to make any analysis of this data. We're just feeling it. We don't look at it. No one really cares. And so that was funny to see how this kind of seemingly convergent processes in management are something completely different. So there's something interesting in China. This case is happy, relatively speaking, it's a well-protected, happy ending, the case of Orson Chariot. There are very many other cases where destruction is in conservation or in exploitation, where you have this places that can do billions of yuan and people exploit them. But also from a professional point of view, I think there is something more different that is not changing in the way that we think. I mean, apparently, that kind of transformation of public sectors all over the world could be similar, but in China it's a bit different. It's not the transformation of already established bureaucracy. It's the building, it's the construction of a sort of Weberian kind of bureaucracy more than, you know, the kind of changes that we are experiencing in Europe or even in the US or even in South America in terms of making the bureaucracy more efficient. So that's an interesting, very interesting example to consider. So,